Chapter 48. Somebody turns up. It has not occurred to me to mention Peggotty since I ran away. But, of course, I wrote her a letter almost as soon as I was housed at Dover, and another, and a longer letter, containing all particulars fully related, when my aunt took me formally under her protection. On my being settled at Dr. Strong's, I wrote to her again, detailing my happy condition and prospects. I never could have derived anything like the pleasure from spending the money Mr. Dick had given me that I felt in sending a gold half guinea to Peggotty, per post, enclosed in this last letter, to discharge the sum I had borrowed of her. In which epistle, not before, I mentioned about the young man with the donkey cart. To these communications Peggotty replied as promptly, if not as concisely, as a merchant's clerk. Her utmost powers of expression, which were certainly not great in ink, were exhausted in the attempt to write what she felt on the subject of my journey. Four sides of incoherent and interjectional beginnings of sentences that had no end, except blots, were inadequate to afford her any relief. But the blots were more expressive to me than the best composition, for they showed me that Peggotty had been crying all over the paper, and what could I have desired more? I made out, without much difficulty, that she could not take quite kindly to my aunt yet. The notice was too short after so long a prepossession the other way. We never knew a person, she wrote, but to think that Miss Betsy should seem to be so different from what she had been thought to be, was a moral. That was her word. She was evidently still afraid of Miss Betsy, for she sent her grateful duty to her but timidly, and she was evidently afraid of me too, and entertained the probability of my running away again soon. If I might judge from the repeated hints she threw out, that the coach fare to Yarmouth was always to be had of her for the asking. She gave me one piece of intelligence which affected me very much, namely, that there had been a sale of the furniture at our old home, and that Mr. and Miss Murdstone were gone away, and the house was shut up, to be let or sold. God knows I had no part in it, while they remained there, but it pained me to think of the dear old place as altogether abandoned. Of the weeds growing tall in the garden, and the fallen leaves lying thick and wet upon the paths. I imagined how the winds of winter would howl round it, how the cold rain would beat upon the window glass, how the moon would make ghosts on the walls of the empty rooms, watching their solitude all night. I thought afresh of the grave in the churchyard, underneath the tree. And it seemed as if the house were dead too now, and all connected with my father and mother were faded away. There was no other news in Peggotty's letters. Mr. Barkis was an excellent husband, she said, though still a little near, but we all had our faults, and she had plenty, though I am sure I don't know what they were, and he sent his duty, and my little bedroom was always ready for me. Mr. Peggotty was well, and Ham was well, and Mrs. Gummidge was but poorly, and little Emily wouldn't send her love, but said that Peggotty might send it, if she liked. All this intelligence I dutifully imparted to my aunt, only reserving to myself the mention of little Emily, to whom I instinctively felt that she would not very tenderly incline. While I was yet new at Dr. Strong's, she made several excursions over to Canterbury to see me, and always at unseasonable hours, with the view, I suppose, of taking me by surprise. But, finding me well employed, and bearing a good character, and hearing on all hands that I rose fast in the school, she soon discontinued these visits. I saw her on a Saturday, every third or fourth week, when I went over to Dover for a treat, and I saw Mr. Dick every alternate Wednesday, when he arrived by stagecoach at noon, to stay until next morning. On these occasions Mr. Dick never travelled without a leathern writing desk, containing a supply of stationery and the memorial, in relation to which document he had a notion that time was beginning to press now, and that it really must be got out of hand. Mr. Dick was very partial to gingerbread. to render his visits the more agreeable, my aunt had instructed me to open a credit for him at a cake shop, which was hampered with the stipulation that he should not be served with more than 1 shilling's worth in the course of any one day. This, and the reference of all his little bills at the county inn where he slept, to my aunt, before they were paid, induced me to suspect that he was only allowed to rattle his money, and not to spend it. I found on further investigation that this was so, or at least there was an agreement between him and my aunt that he should account to her for all his disbursements. As he had no idea of deceiving her, and always desired to please her, he was thus made chary of launching into expense. On this point, as well as on all other possible points, Mr. Dick was convinced that my aunt was the wisest and most wonderful of women, as he repeatedly told me with infinite secrecy, and always in a whisper. Trotwood, apostrophe said Mr. Dick, with an air of mystery, after imparting this confidence to me, one Wednesday, who's the man that hides near our house and frightens her? Apostrophe, apostrophe, frightens my aunt, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Dick nodded. I thought nothing would have frightened her, apostrophe he said, for she's apostrophe here he whispered softly, don't mention it, the wisest and most wonderful of women. Apostrophe having said which, he drew back, to observe the effect which this description of her made upon me. The first time he came, apostrophe said Mr. Dick, was let me see 1649 was the date of King Charles's execution. I think you said 1649? Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, sir. Apostrophe, I don't know how it can be, apostrophe said Mr. Dick, sorely puzzled and shaking his head. I don't think I am as old as that. Apostrophe, was it in that year that the man appeared, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked. Why, really said Mr. Dick, I don't see how it can have been in that year, Trotwood. Did you get that date out of history? Apostrophe, yes, sir. Apostrophe, I suppose history never lies, does it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Dick, with a gleam of hope. Oh dear, no, sir. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I replied, most decisively. I was ingenuous and young, and I thought so. I can't make it out, apostrophe said Mr. Dick, shaking his head. There's something wrong, somewhere. However, it was very soon after the mistake was made of putting some of the trouble out of King Charles's head into my head, that the man first came. I was walking out with Miss Trotwood after tea, just at dark, and there he was, close to our house. Apostrophe, walking about? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I inquired. Walking about? Apostrophe, apostrophe, repeated Mr. Dick. Let me see, I must recollect a bit. And no, no, he was not walking about. Apostrophe, I asked, as the shortest way to get at it, what he was doing. Well, he wasn't there at all, apostrophe said Mr. Dick, until he came up behind her, and whispered. Then she turned round and fainted, and I stood still, and looked at him, and he walked away. But that he should have been hiding ever since in the ground or somewhere is the most extraordinary thing. Apostrophe, apostrophe, has he been hiding ever since? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked. To be sure he has, apostrophe retorted Mr. Dick, nodding his head gravely. Never came out, till last night. We were walking last night, and he came up behind her again, and I knew him again. Apostrophe, and did he frighten my aunt again? Apostrophe, apostrophe, all of a shiver, apostrophe said Mr. Dick, counterfeiting that affection and making his teeth chatter. Held by the palings. Cried. But, Trotwood, come here, apostrophe getting me close to him, that he might whisper very softly, why did she give him money, boy, in the moonlight? Apostrophe, apostrophe, he was a beggar, perhaps. Apostrophe, Mr. Dick shook his head, as utterly renouncing the suggestion, and having replied a great many times, and with great confidence, no beggar, no beggar, no beggar, sir. apostrophe apostrophe went on to say that from his window he had afterwards, and late at night, seen my aunt give this person money outside the garden rails in the moonlight, who then slunk away into the ground again, as he thought probable, and was seen no more. While my aunt came hurriedly and secretly back into the house, and had, even that morning, been quite different from her usual self, which preyed on Mr. Dick's mind. I had not the least belief, in the outset of this story, that the unknown was anything but a delusion of Mr. Dick's, and one of the line of that ill-fated prince who occasioned him so much difficulty. But after some reflection I began to entertain the question whether an attempt, or threat of an attempt, might have been twice made to take poor Mr. Dick himself from under my aunt's protection, and whether my aunt, the strength of whose kind feeling towards him, I knew from herself, might have been induced to pay a price for his peace and quiet. As I was already much attached to Mr. Dick, and very solicitous for his welfare, my fears favored this supposition. And for a long time his Wednesday hardly ever came round, without my entertaining a misgiving that he would not be on the coach box as usual. There he always appeared, however, grey-headed, laughing, and happy, and he never had anything more to tell of the man who could frighten my aunt. These Wednesdays were the happiest days of Mr. Dick's life. They were far from being the least happy of mine. He soon became known to every boy in the school, and though he never took an active part in any game but kite flying, was as deeply interested in all our sports as anyone among us. How often have I seen him, intent upon a match at marbles or peg top, looking on with a face of unutterable interest, and hardly breathing at the critical times. How often, at hare and hounds, have I seen him mounted on a little knoll, cheering the whole field on to action, and waving his hat above his gray head, oblivious of King Charles the Martyr's head, and all belonging to it. How many a summer hour have I known to be but blissful minutes to him in the cricket field? How many winter days have I seen him, standing blue-nosed, in the snow and east wind, looking at the boys going down the long slide, and clapping his worsted gloves in rapture. He was an universal favorite, and his ingenuity in little things was transcendent. He could cut oranges into such devices as none of us had an idea of. He could make a boat out of anything, from a skewer upwards. He could turn cramp bones into chessmen, fashion Roman chariots from old court carts, make spoke wheels out of cotton reels, and bird cages of old wire. But he was greatest of all, perhaps, in the articles of string and straw, with which we were all persuaded he could do anything that could be done by hands. Mr. Dick's renown was not long confined to us. After a few Wednesdays, Dr. Strong himself made some inquiries of me about him, and I told him all my aunt had told me, which interested the doctor so much that he requested, on the occasion of his next visit, to be presented to him. This ceremony I performed, and the doctor begging Mr. Dick, whensoever he should not find me at the coach office, to come on there, and rest himself until our morning's work was over, it soon passed into a custom for Mr. Dick, to come on as a matter of course, and, if we were a little late, as often happened on a Wednesday, to walk about the courtyard, waiting for me. Here he made the acquaintance of the doctor's beautiful young wife, paler than formerly, all this time, more rarely seen by me or anyone, I think, and not so gay, but not less beautiful, and so became more and more familiar by degrees, until, at last, he would come into the school and wait. He always sat in a particular corner, on a particular stool, which was called Dick, after him. Here he would sit, with his gray head bent forward, attentively listening to whatever might be going on, with a profound veneration for the learning he had never been able to acquire. This veneration Mr. Dick extended to the doctor, whom he thought the most subtle and accomplished philosopher of any age. It was long before Mr. Dick ever spoke to him otherwise than bareheaded. And even when he and the doctor had struck up quite a friendship, and would walk together by the hour, on that side of the courtyard which was known among us as the Doctor's Walk. Mr. Dick would pull off his hat at intervals, to show his respect for wisdom and knowledge. How it ever came about that the Doctor began to read out scraps of the famous dictionary in these walks, I never knew. Perhaps he felt it all the same, at first, as reading to himself. However, it passed into a custom to, and Mr. Dick, listening with a face shining with pride and pleasure, in his heart of hearts believed the dictionary to be the most delightful book in the world. As I think of them going up and down before those schoolroom windows, the Doctor reading with his complacent smile, an occasional flourish of the manuscript, or grave motion of his head, and Mr. Dick listening, enchained by interest, with his poor wits calmly wandering God knows where, upon the wings of hard words, I think of it as one of the pleasantest things, in a quiet way, that I have ever seen. I feel as if they might go walking to and fro forever, and the world might somehow be the better for it, as if a thousand things it makes a noise about were not one half so good for it, or me. Agnes was one of Mr. Dick's friends, very soon, and in often coming to the house, he made acquaintance with Uriah. The friendship between himself and me increased continually, and it was maintained on this odd footing, that, while Mr. Dick came professedly to look after me as my guardian, he always consulted me in any little matter of doubt that arose, and invariably guided himself by my advice, not only having a high respect for my native sagacity, but considering that I inherited a good deal from my aunt. One Thursday morning, when I was about to walk with Mr. Dick from the hotel to the coach office, before going back to school, for we had an hour's school before breakfast, I met Uriah in the street, who reminded me of the promise I had made to take tea with himself and his mother, adding, with a writhe, but I didn't expect you to keep it, Master Copperfield, we're so very humble. Apostrophe, I really had not yet been able to make up my mind whether I liked Uriah or detested him, and I was very doubtful about it still, as I stood looking him in the face in the street. But I felt it quite an affront to be supposed proud, and said I only wanted to be asked. Apostrophe O, oh, if that's all, Master Copperfield, apostrophe said Uriah, and it really isn't our humbleness that prevents you, will you come this evening? But if it is our humbleness, I hope you won't mind owning to it, Master Copperfield, for we are well aware of our condition. Apostrophe, I said I would mention it to Mr. Wickfield, and if he approved, as I had no doubt he would, I would come with pleasure. So, at 6 o'clock that evening, which was one of the early office evenings, I announced myself as ready, to Uriah. Mother will be proud, indeed, apostrophe he said, as we walked away together. Or she would be proud, if it wasn't sinful, Master Copperfield. Apostrophe, yet you didn't mind supposing I was proud this morning, apostrophe I returned. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.